Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max, coming to you from New York Law School and its Center for New York City Law, where I'm executive editor and program director. We've got some great events happening here at New York Law School and the Center for New York City Law, so stay tuned for those. And you can always find updates from us at the website citylandnyc.org. We have interesting events coming up, and we'll be adding a lot more to the calendar. And of course, the in-depth policy and politics conversations continue here at Max Politics. Thanks for tuning in for this episode of the show. It's Thursday, March 14th, 2024. It's been another very busy week in New York politics, perhaps an especially busy one, including a few key things that we're digging into here today on a slightly different episode than usual, something of a big news of the week recap and analysis here. And I'll be joined by two great journalists in succession to talk about them. First, in just a minute, we're digging into the 2024 State of the City address and agenda unveiled this week by City Council Speaker Adrian Adams, a Queens Democrat. Then, later in the show, the latest around state housing policy. Also this week, the Democratic majorities in the state legislature's two houses, the State Senate and State Assembly, each unveiled their separate One House budget resolution, setting the stage for the final weeks of negotiations among the two majorities and Governor Kathy Hochul. And housing, of course, remains a top item of concern among New Yorkers that state leaders are trying to come to a deal on, with many policies on the table and a lot of recognition among the governor, legislative leaders, and rank and file legislators that they need to make some real strides on housing policy at the state level this year after they failed to do so last year. My guest today will be first Jeff Colton of Politico, who was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music on Wednesday for Speaker Adams's State of the City address. So he'll join me momentarily to talk about that and the broader political policy dynamics in the city. Then a little bit later in the show, Emma Whitford, deputy editor of City Limits, who covers housing and homelessness, and she just wrote about the new One House budget resolutions at the state level and where the different key parties are on a number of important state housing policy issues. So more with my guests very shortly, two of my favorite journalists of many covering New York politics and policy. In case you've missed any recent episodes of the show here, do check them out in the feed after this one. A few highlights include conversations with State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris, a Queens Democrat. We talked about New York's redistricting saga, which he's been very involved with, and what comes next, as well as a few different areas of state policy and budget negotiations. Before that, recently, an interesting conversation with New York State Inspector General Lucy Lange on her office's work rooting out corruption and waste in New York state government. We've also had recent conversations with State Senator John Liu on oversight of mayoral control of New York City schools, as well as some other issues. A conversation with the New York City Health Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Vasin, on how the Adams administration is addressing the impacts of social media on youth mental health, as well as a few other public health issues that I got into with the health commissioner, and a whole bunch of other great guests. Check any or all of them out after this one if you've missed any in the podcast feed, and do stay tuned for more good ones coming up. I have some really exciting guests in the works for the coming weeks here as we get into the real crunch time of state budget negotiations, and then see what comes out of the state budget, which is due by April 1st, but might be a little bit late into April. And then we get even much more into city budget season, a new city budget due by the July 1st start of the city fiscal year, and a whole bunch of other topics to discuss. We've got some interesting episodes coming up on a wide variety of topics, so stay tuned. But today, right here and now, we have a great show for you. So let's bring on the first of my two guests for this episode, Jeff Colton, a reporter at Politico, co-author of the New York Playbook, a must-read morning newsletter on New York politics. Jeff, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Thank you for the kind words. I'm doing great. Happy to be talking about this speech and whatever else comes up.
Yeah, so City Council Speaker Adrienne Adams delivered her third State of the City address on Wednesday at Brooklyn Academy of Music. Jeff, you were in the building, so let's get into a bit more about what the speaker spoke about and proposed and the accompanying agenda that she laid out and some of the interesting dynamics. So just first, for those that didn't watch it, weren't there, take us in the room for a second. What was the energy like? What was the pomp and circumstance like? How did it go from that perspective?
And there was pomp and circumstance. These things are so funny. I mean, like, I understand the mayor giving a big speech, but the city council speaker, you'd think, could just do something in the chambers or whatever. But no, they have to rent out this gorgeous theater in downtown Brooklyn and bring every elected official and every lobbyist and interest group in the city into this theater. And then, because people are getting together, can't just be a 30-minute speech. No, the speech has to be almost an hour, and there's dancers before, and there's multiple national anthems and multiple prayers from different faiths. I mean, it really becomes a whole production. Of course, this is, I mean, the politicians love to do it because it kind of amplifies the influence, or at least the reputation, of the speaker. And this speaker, I think, more than any, has been very adamant that they are a co-equal branch of government to Mayor Adams. Speaker Adams loves to say co-equal branch of government. Now, legally, I don't think that's technically true, but emotionally, the point is made that the mayor often tries to kind of disparage or swipe aside the city council. And I think stuff like this honestly does play into that for the speaker. It plays into this aspect that that the council is an important piece of government in its own right.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look up when the city council speaker switched that because I know there used to be a State of the City given in the council chambers, and I'm not sure when that shifted, if it was under Christine Quinn as speaker or Melissa Mark-Viverito. One of the two made the switch. I know covering Speaker Melissa Mark-Viverito, she definitely did her State of the City speeches at other locations. I'm just not sure if it had switched before then. So there are so many pieces, any State of the City, State of the State address, State of the Union, right? It's like the elected official gets up there and they give all sorts of things about what they've done, what they're proposing, new initiatives, all sorts of things. So we could list many, many, many things. We won't do that, obviously. I gave some of the highlights in the introduction, but say a little bit about just any couple things that stuck out to you in terms of themes, in terms of specific promises, any couple highlights that really were top of mind for you during or after the speech.
Yeah, so in my coverage for Politico, I was really interested in this idea of the council being a check on the mayor, an oversight body. And the council does introduce and pass legislation on its own, and it can have its own initiatives. But her focus seemed more in this case, her focus seemed to be on overseeing the mayor. I mean, even one of her big new initiatives was specifically like, we are going to do our own report card of agencies. I have a lot of questions on what kind of resources they're going to be using for this, and what form it's going to take. But there's this idea of, we are using our oversight powers. And I interpreted that, or at least I think it's interesting, because this is the rare city council speaker who is not openly eyeing higher office. She's term limited at the end of 2025. And I mean, maybe she could luck into Greg Meeks's congressional seat if the timing works out. But most likely, she's just gonna like retire, or go like be a chairperson at a nonprofit or something. I think she is not gonna run for mayor like we've seen so many previous city council speakers, or in MMV's case, run for public advocate. So I think Adams, I think Adrienne really is less focused on kind of boosting her own reputation and getting big time like wins for herself. And it really does seem to be more about the body. And I think maybe lets her give a speech like this that really is about checking the mayor, about oversight. That said, she had a couple new things. She wants to build housing at the Aqueduct racetrack.
So, I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things. She talked about housing at the racetrack in her district. So that was a very interesting point that I thought was so interesting how it tied into the larger city conversation that both the mayor and the speaker have been sort of leading together, which is that the city needs more housing everywhere, and neighborhoods of the city, elected officials in the city where you haven't been sort of pulling your weight to add housing and helping the city grow and reduce the affordability crisis, guess what? It's time to step up. And so they've both been hitting those notes in an area clearly of agreement, at least broadly speaking. We'll see when push comes to shove on, the mayor's zoning proposal for City of Yes and how that all goes, and any specific projects, that might become more controversial. But they've definitely been broadly aligned on that issue. But it was really interesting to hear her get up there and say, listen to me, lead by example. I want to bring a lot of housing to this site in my district. So I thought that was interesting. And then on the connecting it to the broader point, she talked about housing on top of libraries, right? And pursuing that strategy, which we've seen in one or two places recently across the city. But obviously there's a huge amount of potential for that idea. So I thought that was interesting.
Oh yeah, it's part of just this such a clear culture shift in city government, from being, frankly, the place where housing proposals go to die, to now being everybody seems to be rallying around this idea of we need to build more housing. Of course, without massive state action, it seems to be mostly rhetoric. Mostly, all they can do is cheerlead and rah-rah. But we are seeing, a culture shift and a movement towards just this idea that, like, you do have to build more housing, and very much something that I think we're all going to be keeping an eye on. As the City of Yes proposal goes before the council, are members going to say, okay, yeah, like let's throw our support behind this and build?
Right. I mean, I think not to get too out ahead of the conversation there, but it seems like there is a real growing chorus, including from the speaker, for a general support of many of these changes to the zoning code that the mayor and his team at City Planning have proposed. The question, of course, will be how much do sort of forces within the council water it down to then pull back its potential for adding housing growth in the city? And that's where we get into the nitty-gritty of the details. And thank you, by the way, for teeing up again the second part of the episode today, where we'll talk about the state and housing policy. But we'll get to that with my next guest.
It's the hottest issue. Yep.
It is, it is. And I thought, I mean, I think your point about the focus on oversight and accountability of the mayoral administration by the city council was clearly either the biggest takeaway or one of the top couple of the speech. And I do find it very fascinating because you have a situation where, broadly speaking, the speaker and the mayor are allies. They get along seemingly very well. There's obviously been a bunch of moments of tension. There's ongoing legal battles, budget battles. There's been veto overrides. But it's interesting because, in a way, the speaker doesn't have to do these things. She, like you said, has less than 2 years left in her time in the city council, probably isn't running for higher office, or at least probably isn't running for mayor. To launch new agency report cards is a pretty, sort of bold move. We'll see what the implementation looks like. To say that the mayoral administration is not properly implementing the streets plan law, so the council is going to pursue legislation that mandates a project tracker on that. These are some of the things that obviously council members broadly might be clamoring for, but it's interesting that the speaker leaned in so hard on that theme, I thought, and maybe you can
Right. I
talk
mean,
a little
holding
bit
the
about.
mayor accountable of to like to actually implement the laws that are passed. Yeah, that's not like a big, you can't put that on a TV commercial. It's a little more subtle, but it's a fascinating issue about their relationship. Yeah, the streets master plan, closing Rikers is another example where the mayor is kind of like, I don't know if it's going to happen, and the council is very much on board. Generally, majority of the council members are very much on board closing Rikers, building these new jails. Then the city feps, expanding the housing vouchers. The council passed that bill, and the mayor's just refusing to implement it. Says it's an impossible to implement bill. the council is suing him. So yeah, there's real moments of tension. And then of course we saw these other vetoes with the solitary confinement bill and the How Many Stops Act, and both of those have been passed over the mayor's veto. Questions about how and whether they're going to be implemented also. So yeah, I do think that the mayor and the speaker do have genuine affection for each other, both being of the same age, from Southeast Queens, went to Bayside High School together. She's the first ever Black speaker. He's the second ever Black mayor. I think there's a real hesitation to be fighting publicly, in large part because of that. But there are definitely a lot of actual disagreements
Yeah.
and policy fights between the two.
Well, and she started off the speech really focusing in on, cultural funding, and that obviously gets at this issue of the way the mayor has slashed library funding, among other things, and the city council is very upset about that, as are obviously the heads of the library system and many New Yorkers who use the libraries who are not happy that they're now closed on Sundays pretty much across the city and threatening other closures based on funding levels that will come out of this next budget. So is it, that was an interesting place to start, and she tied it to being at BAM, obviously a cultural institution in the city. But that was pretty interesting too. This idea, it struck me too, though, that a big theme for the speaker continues to be the city workforce. She has a couple proposals. She's working with the union DC 37 on some of it that she announced, and CUNY. But she's had an ongoing focus, as have many council members, on filling vacancies and how vacancies in city agencies ties in with performance and the underperformance of city agencies on things like, getting food stamps approved and closing housing deals and all sorts of services across city government. It struck me listening to her that this idea of sort of basic functions of city government, she called it back to basics, and she talked about, public sector strength. I thought that was also pretty interesting as a theme to sort of call, in a sense, sort of call out the blue collar mayor about the way that he's managing the city government and the workforce. And he would, of course, point to fiscal constraints and things like that. But I thought that was also another interesting piece of that, where Eric Adams ran obviously on crime and public safety, but he also ran on sort of city government management, and that theme sort of coming back to bite him in a way, I thought pretty interesting.
I am you. I remember him saying that so many times to speaking to union members, because he was a EBA union member and still pulls that police pension. He's like the first union member mayor in a generation or something in like 100 years. So that is a big part for him. And, on one hand, he has settled all effectively every single one of the union contracts to with pretty generous payouts, and his defense has always been, I want to treat these, I want to make sure that these workers can afford New York City. So he's being good to the unions, but you're right, he's not backfilling the jobs, and that's just been the way that the city has saved money. I mean, in this time of a strained budget, paying people, having employees on the books is like incredibly expensive, and it's the easiest way to save money is just not filling jobs and not paying salaries. And that's, of course, the speaker's I guess response it, the speaker's response is saying, well, if you're not filling these jobs, then the services aren't being rendered as well as they once were, or aren't being rendered at all. So yeah, it really is a balance of saving the money on the mayor's end, but then this very real problems that we get from having a shrunken city workforce. So yeah, I think that's a very interesting aspect of her speech. I agree,
Right, you have the
talking
mayor,
about that problem.
and you have the mayor, clearly overall allied with many of the city's public and private sector unions, and having support from many of them during the campaign, not all obviously, but then dealing with lawsuits from DC 37 over his budget maneuvers, and the UFT, which was again not one of those allied unions, but some really interesting dynamics there around. the mayor's alliances with labor and other key constituencies. As you get at, though, complicated because he settled the contracts from point of view on the mayor's right, which, we don't always hear those voices, but, point of view on the mayor's right has been that those contracts were actually not great deals for the city because they didn't require any givebacks from the unions, and he sort of just, took care of the raises and things like that and moved on. So that you could say, in a sense, somewhat generous. I'm sure there's plenty of labor leaders and members who think they should have been more so, especially, given inflation and all that. But then on the
As is
flip
their job,
side,
of course.
right. And then on the flip side, though, you get this issue of not filling these tens of thousands of vacancies that were budgeted for a long time and not filled for various reasons. So, sort of a mixed bag there. The sort of migrant crisis was like kind of, part of the speaker's state of the city, but, it reminded me to an extent of the mayor's state of the city and the governor's state of the state, where these leaders get up for these big speeches and they don't really want to talk about, this big crisis facing the city and state that much in this moment. That's much more about sort of generating better headlines for them. So I thought that was also interesting, although the speaker did speak about it a bit. Maybe I'm overlooking some of the things that she
Well,
said, but I know.
her brief moment was about that management. I mean, she was saying, we're going to bring together this group, this outside group, to help bring migrants into the city's life. I forget the wording she used, but I mean, it was about kind of moving new immigrants, new arrivals to New York from living in the tent and being in the city's homeless system, just into being everyday New Yorkers. And this is something the mayor has talked about a lot, but I think the speaker was basically saying that she doesn't think that the administration is doing a good enough job at that, and so that's why they need to convene a task force. Of course, it's funny, I mean, what can the city council do? They can only convene a task force. They're limited in their power and their budget, and the answer to everything is task force.
Looking it up as you're as you were talking here, I think it was the new arrival strategy team, is the proposal that they're calling it. So that'll be interesting to see what they can put together there. So just in our final minutes, just wanted to get your sense a little bit more broader political atmosphere of the city. The mayor's obviously facing some campaign finance related investigations and some scandals and some top aides who've been searched, investigated. He obviously had his buildings commissioner resign, all sorts of these things swirling that have hurt his political standing. Challenges with management of some of city services and the ways in which he's handled the migrant crisis, although of course very, very challenging situation for him, or anyone who would be in his position. Was there anything else that sort of stood out to you about the atmosphere that was either in the room there or more broadly speaking as we come to a close here? I do think it's worth mentioning again that the mayor was in the room for the city council speaker's State of the City. I don't remember Bill de Blasio going to any of the State of the City addresses during the two speakerships of his mayoralty. So I think that's a sign of respect that Mayor Adams has given to Speaker Adams. And I do think that matters both personally and politically. But there's people circling, obviously, about challenging the mayor, including one or two city council members. Anything else about sort of the broader political atmosphere that the speaker's State of the City got at, or that you're just sort of thinking about coming out of one of these big days of the political year?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm just too focused on the drama or whatever, but there's been this general sense among the gadflies around City Hall that, like, the City Council for the first 2 years of Speaker Adams' tenure was just boring. Like, nothing was happening. There was no drama. They had no power with the mayor. And I think there's now a general sense that that's changed, that now it's like, oh, okay, they're overriding the mayor's vetoes. They're pushing back. Maybe the speaker has kind of gotten a little more hang of the job. And also, they're in a much better negotiating position with the city budget this year because they were the ones, the council was the one saying there's more money to go around. Like, like, Adams, what, you know, Mayor, what are you doing making all these cuts? We don't need to. And a couple months later, the mayor agreed, and the council's position was kind of justified. So look, the mayor's team would disagree with my classification there, but the point is that the council's in a better negotiating position with this budget. This is the speaker's third budget, and I expect her to have a little more influence and maybe a little more oomph with the mayor this year, even though we have such a strong mayor system in New York City, and that the position of mayor is just, you know, it's much more powerful. But we're seeing that shift a little bit. We're seeing the tilt get a little less tilty, and I think Speaker Adrian Adams is one to watch for the remaining 2 years of her term.
And that does coincide, of course, with many of the new members of the city council getting that first 2-year term under their belt, and then most of them winning re-election, getting a little more settled into their roles. Then you, of course, have some of them who are going to be term limited out, in addition to the speaker, who are starting to look at needing their next, figure out their next move, whether it's running for another office or finding something else. So, yeah, a lot of the stakes are getting raised here. And obviously, like a lot of what will happen with the city budget process will take a new turn once we see a state budget, either in well, probably sometime in April. And it's so interesting. I talked when the mayor gave his recent state of the city. I had on Christina Greer and Harry Siegel from the FAQ NYC podcast, and we were just chatting a little bit about the way the mayor's approached the budget. And you just reminded me of this because it's a little bit about, whether he now, because he's played it somewhat conservative over the first couple of years, whether now, as he starts to eye his reelection, he can loosen up a little bit on some of this and continue to sort of restore some of the cuts or pull back on some of the threatened cuts and things like that, and generate a little more sort of goodwill for himself by, loosening up on some of that more conservative approach to some of the budgeting. So that'll be interesting to watch as well. Any final thought here, Jeff Colton?
Yeah, no, it's the time for the budget dance, and the mayor can give out gifts that he pulled away a couple months ago. We've been seeing that constantly of no, you can have more trash can funding, more pay for human service workers. I'm sure libraries are going to be next. It's an interesting back and forth with the city budget this year.
Jeff Colton is a reporter with Politico and co-author of New York Playbook. Jeff, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
And as I shortly bring on my second guest, Emma Whitford of City Limits, to talk about state housing policy negotiations, just another thank you to Jeff Colton of Politico. You should, of course, subscribe if you don't already to the New York Playbook that comes every morning from the great Politico team that Jeff is a part of, with his Playbook co-authors Emily Ngo and Nick Reisman. And they also get contributions from other members of the Politico team and have great editors over there like Joe Spector and Sally Goldenberg. Just a really great team covering New York politics and policy at Politico, and appreciate Jeff's time. The conversation with Jeff got into a few pieces of City Council Speaker Adrian Adams's State of the City speech and agenda, as I said during the conversation. And Jeff said there's so many aspects to it, like so many State of the City speeches and agendas, or State of the State or State of the Union. We couldn't get into it all. I encourage people, if you're looking for all the specific planks of her agenda, to obviously find those documents on the City Council website. We talked about a few things. I had mentioned that one of the things that the speaker sort of talked about proposing was a program to add a lot more housing on top of city libraries. One thing we didn't mention in the conversation was that she really also, along with library funding, which I mentioned, she also put a real focus on how the Adams administration, the mayoral administration, is reducing funding and, in her view, not managing well the city's 3K sort of preschool program. And so that's another real key point of contention between the council and the mayor, as well as the implementation that we mentioned of the streets plan law for more bus lanes and bike lanes, the issue of unfilled city government positions, delays in social services, and a whole bunch more. She did preview a few different aspects of legislation, including a push to build more housing on top of libraries that I mentioned, using zoning incentives to increase the use of housing vouchers in private developments. She talked about potential legislation around requiring peer-to-peer mental health training for students. She talked about pursuing ways to revamp how sex education is taught in public schools. A whole bunch of proposals in this agenda from the city council speaker. So just wanted to mention again that we didn't get to nearly everything in that conversation with Jeff Colton. There's a lot to it. And the speaker, speaking of housing that we're about to get into in terms of state housing policy, the speaker did also mention at the city level the idea of revisiting the details of the city's mandatory inclusionary housing program to pursue deeper affordability in some of those requirements. And mandatory inclusionary housing, you may recall, kicks in when the city grants a rezoning to allow a developer to build bigger, that it comes with a mandatory requirement of a certain percentage of the new units to be affordable. And there's choices that can come into play by the developer or in conjunction between the developer and the city council about which band of number of units and the affordability requirements. And this can also apply to rezoned areas of the city. If there's a neighborhood rezoning, that mandatory inclusionary housing then gets added, mapped on to those rezoned areas. So she's talking about redoing some of the formulas involved to insist on some levels of deeper affordability at times among those choices. So that was another interesting piece of the speaker's agenda there. All right, as we move towards our state housing policy conversation here on the show, I just wanted to briefly mention that you have both of the One House budget resolutions now out from the New York State Senate and the New York State Assembly. Both houses of the legislature have a Democratic supermajority. These proposals are now going to become part of the negotiations with Governor Kathy Hochul, who put her agenda and her executive budget out earlier this year. Both the leaders of the two houses of the legislature, State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, both stressing the importance of housing to their chambers, One House budget resolutions when they have released information about them or when they've talked to the press about them. So this is clearly top of mind for the governor, for the two legislative majorities. And the key here now is, will they get to a deal? And will they get to a deal anytime soon? So now for more on that. And now let me bring on Emma Whitford, Deputy Editor of City Limits, who covers housing and homelessness for the publication, and she just wrote about the new housing proposals that are in the One House budget resolutions for the New York State Senate and New York State Assembly majorities. These proposals, the two One House budget resolutions, are sort of a restatement of priorities by the two legislative majorities in the two houses, and they are now going to form a lot of the basis for the negotiations among those two majorities, as well as the office of Governor Kathy Hochul, as the three parties try to get to a budget deal before, on, around the April 1st start of the new fiscal year. It's important to note as we get into this housing policy conversation that it doesn't have to happen in the budget. The budget can often be a place where lots of deals come together, but at its essence, of course, it is a fiscal document and a fiscal agreement about state taxes and spending and, you know, different forms of revenue and expenditures. Housing policy can sometimes have a little bit of that involved, but is often not necessarily a budget item. So there is, of course, the possibility that no deal gets done in the state budget, and then the parties are continuing to negotiate in the legislative session weeks to follow. The state legislative session this year is set to wrap up in early June. They could go longer than that, but then they will also be bumping up against this year's primary elections, which are set for late June. So a lot to keep an eye on. I guess the other possibility I should mention is they do some housing stuff in the budget and then they keep negotiating on other parts of this. But the bottom line is many, many parties, both in state government and in New York City government, and advocates and place people in government around the state, and New Yorkers generally, are looking to Albany leaders for some kind of significant housing policy package. Emma, let's try to give people an overview of where we're at now that the two legislative majorities have put out their proposals. So let's just sort of cover some of the big pieces here. But say a little bit broadly speaking about sort of how, you know, there's probably somewhere in the vicinity of a dozen housing policies that are sort of part of the discussion here. But some of the biggest ones, of course, are the replacement of the 421A tax credit to try to incentivize apartment building development that includes some affordable housing. And then this question of what kind of tenant protection via something like a good cause eviction bill. But there's a lot more to it. So how would you sort of capture for people where we're at right now and some of the big pillars and where the three main parties here are on them?
Yeah, and first of all, thanks for having me, Ben. That was a good way of diving into this. The way I framed my story this week is I kind of went back to last June, the very end of last year's legislative session, which is when Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Heastie put out a press release, sort of throwing up their hands, being like, here are all these things that we sort of wanted, that we wanted to get done this session, and we couldn't come to a deal. And those things were very broad, like the text was never really written out, but we're talking about some sort of tax incentive for development, good cause eviction protections, an expanded new voucher program for the entire state, some ways to upgrade rent stabilized units that need repairs. So none of that got done. And now here we are almost a year later, and a lot of those things are still in discussion. We all know, I'm sure you've talked about on your podcast, but how Governor Hochul's sort of seminal 2023 housing plan to sort of use a stick approach to encourage development did not happen. So she's not taking that path this year, but she does really seem in public comments to be leading with development incentives. She wants, shovels in the ground, increasing housing supply point blank. And then we have on the legislator side, some discussion about increasing development, but always kind of in lockstep with talking about some sort of tenant protections. We've got the Senate talking more explicitly about the quote core principles of good cause eviction. The quick and dirty on that is, Julia Salazar is the Senate sponsor on that bill. It's been around since 2019. This was sort of the one piece of the goals of the HSTPA from that year, which really expanded rent stabilization protections that didn't come through. And every year it's been kind of a fight to get it back in, and has really been both like a third rail for the real estate industry and something that Hochul has very much refused to entertain. So it's almost like stepping back up to bat again with a lot of the same things in play. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Say a little bit more about let's start with good cause eviction and what this discussion is really shaping up like here in the middle of March. There's talk about support for, again, as you sort of said, the core principles of good cause eviction. Where is that at in each of the legislative majorities, one house proposals? The governor has said she wants to protect tenants, but isn't she's actually more focused on adding supply, which in a way is its own, protection for tenants in a way. And obviously that necessitates a lot more housing coming online where tenants have more leverage in their negotiations with landlords and developers. But where, this I've always found one of the most interesting pieces of this discussion, which is that you don't necessarily see either house of the legislature with a full-throated support for the full good cause eviction bill. And that to me has been interesting and telling, right? Because again, it has to be said in this whole discussion, the legislature could pass any piece of legislation it wants. It passes hundreds of bills a year. If there was a huge clamoring and support for good cause eviction, the two houses could pass it and send it to the governor to make a decision on. They haven't done that, right? They want it to be part of a grand bargain. But there continue to be these indications that there's not necessarily majority support in either house for the full good cause eviction bill. What's your lay of the land on that? Let's start with that one now.
Yeah. So I talked to the housing committee chairs of both the Senate and the Assembly this week, and asked them point blank, like, what are your, you know, hard line, like what would have to go in or out of some negotiated good cause? And neither of them would say. I mean, the bill as written basically gives renters in unregulated housing a defense against eviction as long as they're keeping up with their rent and not violating their lease. We get a whole other discussion about, I think, sort of inaccurate descriptions of what the bill does. I think, you know, it's not like a guaranteed lease renewal or anything like that. But it also gives you a defense against a large rent increase. I know from the tenant advocate side, some of their primary concerns based on some of the scuttle at the end of last session is they don't want to see a negotiated version of this that would be, you know, applied to New York City and then have the rest of the state opting in, or a version of it that would exclude more than like the very smallest owner occupied buildings. Mm-hmm. So I think those are some concerns about potential negotiations, but you're right. I mean, like neither side is going to explicitly say good cause. And I think it's a testament to the lobbying that's been happening on the real estate side and, you know, some of the successful messaging about, you know, potential consequences of the legislation.
So, you know, it's interesting. When I read core principles of good cause, I think of two things. One, you can't be evicted without good cause, right? So, and then defining that in law. So that is about, as you say, you can't really be evicted if you are, you know, paying your rent and you're not some sort of nuisance to the building or to the owner or to the neighborhood or whatever, you know, whatever those other real issues of cause would be. And then the second piece, though, which is not so explicitly in the name, is this idea of capping the rent increases that are allowed each year, each lease renewal. And that seems to be the piece where, you know, there's seemingly more hesitation among legislators, because, you know, most of the evictions that are happening now across the city and state seem to sort of actually fall under what would still be, you know, potentially possible under the first part of what I laid out. But it's this second piece of putting in new sort of rent controls, to use that term broadly, that seems to be some of the real sticking area. Have any of the legislative leaders or the housing chairs indicated if they see that sort of regulation of rent increases as a core principle that would have to be part of a deal?
Well, I guess a few things here. So one thing that I think is important to understand, like, rather than so much as like a cap, like, you know, I think of like in rent stabilization, right? The allowable annual increases that the rent guidelines board set, those are pretty firm and you can't really go above them. I think the challenge with good cause, if it were to pass, and this is like getting ahead of ourselves, is I think there is like a lot of inertia in the rental market. Like in order for a tenant to really avail themselves of the bill as written, it would kind of take you being like a really informed renter, probably with some information from an organization, your landlord goes to raise your rent a lot, and then you like refuse to sign the lease, also refuse to leave, your landlord then takes you to court, and then you point to the law. So it's like, there'd be a lot of education and work around that side of it. Another point I wanted to make was on the sort of rent increases laid out in the bill as written. I think it's like 3% or 1.5 times the consumer price index. When I talked to, like, we've in the past talked to Julia Salazar and like other tenant advocates, I think they're more firm on, at least from the advocacy side, more firm on not losing ground on the geography and the building size thing, and more flexible on the potential amounts that like rents could increase without that defense. Like, so that's looking at places like New Jersey and California are more, I think, flexible. I think in New Jersey, I mean, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but I think it's something about like an unconscionable rent increase, which would be more of like for up to a judge's discretion or something, rather than spelled out explicitly at the levels that it currently is. So I think we might see that as a point of negotiation.
Yeah, you actually get me back to one of the other things I was going to mention, which was at the end of the last legislative session last year, talking with State Senator Salazar on this podcast and talking about the compromise version of Good Cause that was actually being floated. It was a very watered down version of the sort of more pure bill, and you have heard a lot from legislators, including herself and advocates, saying, we don't want that compromised version of the bill that was being discussed last year. That's not something we want on the table this year. So it's very, very interesting because there were a lot of sort of concessions made. But part of the essence of that, which I want to sort of move into the other pieces of the equation here, part of the discussion around what the potential parameters of a compromise around good cause would be are what's the other pieces of the package, right? And so, I think in some ways the question is for people like Governor Hochul, some members of the legislature, obviously some in the real estate community, and that's a very diverse community, but developers, especially landlords, the question is there potentially enough in a deal, if you're being asked to sort of sign on to it, or sign off on it if you're not part of the parties making it, but that incentivizes development, creates more housing that, in some ways offsets what you see as the problems with a good cause bill. And so I think, again, that's where we get into more tension, which is what is there on that front? There's obviously not, as you got at, there's not Governor Hochul's housing compact of sort of mandatory growth around the state. That's off the table. So, in some universe, you could imagine, people on sort of the governor's side of the table saying, well, give us the housing compact and we can do a version of good cause, but that's not even on the table right now because there wasn't enough support, for that. So she totally removed it from this year's agenda, for a variety of reasons. So what's being talked about in terms of incentivizing development? There's some discussion of a replacement for the old 421A tax break program. There's some discussion of also, I think, extending the eligibility for projects that were going to get the old 421A. Yeah, say a little bit about sort of what's being discussed on the development side. And then there's other pieces beyond those two things, right?
So on the 421A replacement, I think there are a couple interesting things going on this year. One of them is, when I talked to Linda Rosenthal this week, she is a legislator who had very critical things to say about 421A as it existed before it expired. Part of a chorus of voices that would say that, it was too much incentive for not enough return in terms of affordability. And she was saying herself this week, like, she hasn't changed her tune on that. But just like one thing that seems slightly different from last year is you do have like Kavanaugh and Rosenthal expressing openness to some 421A replacement. The Senate like explicitly tied that to good cause, but it just seems like in general more entertaining of like talking about 421A when it used to be sort of like a boogeyman the last couple of years. I don't know what that's really going to mean. I mean, another weird thing is that, Hochul a few years ago presented her own answer to 421A and it was rejected. And she took a really soft touch this year, calling it a placeholder herself. So I was reading a good story that City and State did about this earlier, but just like there are so many unknowns. Like, even though there seems to be from the legislature, like more interest in like talking about a new tax incentive, like details just like really don't exist, especially with 3 weeks out from the budget deadline. So that
And I mean, and
is
that is where
interesting.
the governor and others are sort of, I think Speaker Hastie said this too, sort of looking to private entities to negotiate wage deals and negotiate pieces of the puzzle around what a tax incentive for developers could look like, because the governor, labor leaders, legislators want there to be certain labor standards as well as certain affordability standards involved in the new program. And again, you're getting into some very complicated regulations for a program which, developers certainly will say, if you overregulate this program, you might replace 421A in sort of broad terms, but you're not actually going to spur the development that you want to spur. That, you know, those are questions that I can't necessarily answer because you're getting into like actually the specifics of how various projects, you know, quote unquote, pencil out financially. But it's really complicated what's going on. And to your point, they, you know, only have a couple of weeks on this, and the question of what they'll write into potential legislation around those labor standards or things like putting in legislation that, you know, the Real Estate Board of New York and various labor unions need to come to agreements on these things for a program to move forward. I mean, you're getting into very tricky territory there.
Yes,
But go ahead
definitely.
on the other pieces of the puzzle related to spurring development.
Well, there are a lot of these priorities that Mayor Eric Adams has had for 2 years running, tax incentive to convert office buildings into apartments. There's this idea, this isn't so much spurring development, but basement and cellar legalization, which has been a priority for Mayor Adams, and Hochul has also put a version of that in her budget proposal 2 years running. But once again, the Senate and the Assembly both excluded basement cellar legalization. I did a story last year about some of the parts of New York City, including like Eastern Queens, where there seem to be legislators who are like very much opposed to that sort of plan. I saw the Senate put in their proposal like a potential like optional tax incentive for ADUs. I guess another piece of it is where all three sort of overlap is this idea of increasing development on state-owned public land. That was part of Hochul's plan. She's estimating that she could get about like 15,000 units of housing out of that, which compared to like, her estimates for the broader statewide housing compact is pretty small. But it does seem like all three parties are interested in coming up with some way to like really take advantage of the land that the city that the public already has in its control. And then
In that,
advocates put, oh yeah, go ahead.
no, just quickly in that vein, it's different, but it's similar. There's seems to be some momentum around this faith-based housing legislation that could potentially be part of a bigger housing package or maybe passed on its own, which would allow faith-based institutions a much more sort of streamlined process for building housing on land that they already own. Is that fair to say from your read that that seems to have some momentum behind it and doesn't seem like something that would necessarily be a big sticking point for the governor if the legislature was on board?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting you point that out. It sort of seems like indicative of the mood of this session. Like, it's a relatively small scale proposal, but it does have support from like, the left wing of the Democratic Party in the legislature. And I think, Senator Comrie, who is very much opposed to things like legalization, things like that. It does seem to have some like wide spectrum support on it. I think the flip side of that is like hard to say exactly like what the, maybe not like the largest scale initiative, but definitely something that does seem to be something of a compromise
And then
potential.
one of the other pieces here is this idea of a statewide housing voucher program, often referred to as Housing Access Voucher Program or HAVP, which again has been sort of pushed by the legislature for at least starting a program with $250 million for several years now, I think. And the governor has not gotten on board, in part claiming that it would potentially cost a lot more than that. I've never quite understood that response to it because obviously, if you're allocating money towards it and approving new legislation to create it, you could put a cap on how much the program is allowed to spend. The issue with it that I found, you know, sort of more convincing in terms of problems is adding more vouchers when you're not adding more housing supply just means more competition, you know, for vouchers and more people with vouchers competing with people who don't have vouchers and just more of that renter competition. Which is a problem if you're not, you know, adding more supplies. We see these, you know, minuscule vacancy rates. the only counterpoint to that, just to make sure I'm giving at least somewhat of a full picture, is if you're offering, if you're offering vouchers to people who are already in homes to help pay for the rent so they're not evicted and don't become homeless, then that's different, obviously, to giving vouchers to people who are in shelter looking and competing again for those scarce properties. So,
Yeah, I was going to make
yeah.
that point. I mean, I know there are lots of factors here, but part of the debate over voucher expansion at the New York City level too, with the City PHEPS program, has been just that. This interest in getting vouchers into the hands of people who are housed but not stably housed, to like stay in their current homes. Yeah, I mean, back to like that pesky term of tenant protections, like there are, the coalition that is very much opposed to good cause. They are like, we would like to see tenant protections, but what we're talking about is more access to lawyers in housing courts around the state and more vouchers in the form of HAVP. Like there is like talk about like in the way that the faith-based housing thing is drawing like, historical opponents agreeing with something. HAVP definitely does seem to be that. And the Assembly and Senate both put in $250 million for it in their proposals, as they did last year. I think it'll be interesting to see if there's some movement there, because I can almost see that as like more of a palatable, quote unquote, tenant protection to the governor than, some version of good cause.
Right, and you're getting at the idea also there of a bit of a push for a sort of right to counsel law at the state level, or at least some sort of increased program to provide attorneys to people facing eviction. Another piece of the puzzle here. It's so interesting, and I'll have more conversations with people who are sort of more politically involved in all this, but it's so interesting to look at like these long lists of housing related proposals. And of course, the details all matter, but it's very interesting if you sort of take this big list and you say, well, what if they figured out a way to do it all? It almost all sort of works together if you do it all, in theory. But when they're sort of haggling over the piece, all the different pieces, and don't seem to have that much legislative momentum for some of the bigger pieces, that's where I think a lot of the crux comes in, not to mention needing the gubernatorial support for some of the bigger pieces as well. Just fascinating dynamics. Emma, I want to get you out of here soon, but a couple other things to just touch on here as we talk about where negotiations are at the state level. There is this issue of that you mentioned early in this conversation around vacancies in rent stabilized apartments. I don't know what numbers to trust. Maybe you can help me out here. There's different numbers coming from a lot of different entities and agencies about estimating roughly how many vacant rent stabilized apartments there are in New York City. There are landlord groups who are claiming a very high number, and they're saying a big reason for that high number is because of those updates to the rent laws that were passed in 2019. And they're saying that as soon as people vacate some of these rent stabilized apartments, they've been living in them for decades, they need a massive amount of work to get up to code. And the way that the law was changed in 2019 does not allow the building owners to come anywhere close to breaking even if they invest in those apartments, and then can only still charge a very low rent stabilized rent. So they have a proposal they want to try to be able to bring those units up to market rate or use of a voucher, different proposals for bringing them online. But there's some people who say there's 2,000 of these vacant rent stabilized units. There's people who are saying it's closer to 30,000. So A, do we have any idea what the true number is? And B, is there a live discussion in Albany about doing something about it? Whatever the number might be.
Yes and yes. Okay, so let's talk about the numbers. I have found it helpful to refer to the Housing Vacancy Survey. The 2023 one just recently came out. And for
And this
people
is
who are
put out
not
by this.
familiar,
Oh, go ahead.
yeah, so it's HPD, and working in conjunction with the U.S. Census Bureau. It's been going on for a while. It's basically how the city checks to see if it is currently in a state of quote unquote housing emergency, which is a vacancy rate of under 5%. And that's what holds up our rent stabilization system. So you mentioned a number close to 30,000. So starting there, this year's housing vacancy survey found that there were 26,300-ish unit rent stabilized apartments that were both vacant and not available for rent. So that is, I'm just going to kind of leave it at that. I mean, that's sort of where you're starting from. And then the 2000 number you were alluding to, it's around 1700. It's kind of like a yes and situation. So HPD drilled down on that number by saying, okay, so there's that whole universe of empty rent stabilized units that are not currently like on the market available for rent. Let's look at the share of that that rents for under like $1,500 or less, because that's the median rent stabilized rent according to the survey. And then let's look at the share of those that have been vacant for over a year, because some of the thinking there is that like there is some level of churn in apartments. So if like knowing that there's no real definition of quote unquote warehousing, like is their way of trying to get at, okay, what are the units that like for all intents and purposes, like have not been rentable for some time. So it's $1,500 or less as the like legal rent on the unit, vacant for over a year. And then you're looking at some of these qualifications that the survey uses. I think it's like dilapidated, and there's another term, quote, otherwise uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you're looking at this share, like talking to, you know, groups like CHIP, they are going to be more focused on that 26,000, like 26,000 number as like a broader universe of impacted units. I think they're skeptical of the census approach to narrowing it down to this smaller slice. But I'm talking to both, you know, the Senate Assembly housing chairs this week, they're very much focused on that smaller number, which they say this smaller universe are like the very, you know, all these conditions like vacant for more than a year, pretty low legal rent. So it's not like the landlord could get much return on rent if like the apartment needs are like the repair needs are really steep. Like they want to focus on how do we, you know, give cash infusions to this number that they claim to be the most relevant number. So I know that's a lot, but it has sparked a broader discussion. One thing that I find really unique about and unusual about this year's session is, you know, going back to 2019, that was like a huge victory year for tenants with the passage of the HSTPA. It removed a lot of the avenues for rent stabilized landlords to increase rents. And one of the victories there was capping how much you can increase rent based on apartment improvements called IAIs, individual apartment improvements. And both the Senate and Assembly are actively talking about potentially increasing that amount for IAIs, maybe pegging it to inflation. So that feels like a very new conversation to me this year and some indication that like some of what landlords have been saying has been getting through. That said, legislation that would allow for like a potentially much larger increase upon vacancy, there's a Comrie Burgos bill that would look at apartments that become vacant after a 10-year tenancy, allowing to use voucher standards. You know, that, at least from the chairs in both housing committees, is getting shot down pretty hard, but who knows what negotiations are happening behind the scenes there.
Okay, that's definitely going to be a key piece of the puzzle that's a little bit outside of what, you know, most of the discussion around the housing policy discussion in Albany is focused on, you know, the developer incentives to build more rental housing, the good cause stuff that we talked about. There's also several other bills, some of which you mentioned. There's even more that we didn't mention, but I think we gave people a lot of specifics to sink their teeth into. Any last thing you want to mention on this discussion before I let you go? Anything we didn't get to here on the Albany sort of housing debate? I know, you know, the sort of mayor has his ass of Albany. You mentioned some of those.
Yeah, maybe just a sort of a point that's like indicative of what it's been like to cover the, you know, this broader debate this year, going back to Mayor Adams. You know, it seems like he has been expressing some like eagerness for a broader deal, of course, and just the sort of like confusing rhetoric around quote unquote tenant protections and good cause. There was like an interview in Crane's, I think, earlier in the session where he said he would be open to good cause. And then on Tin Cup Day, he, you know, backpedaled on that and was like, I didn't say good cause, I said tenant protection. So I think the like big takeaway question for the coming weeks is what are tenant protections and how do they fit into some potential broader deal? Or are we headed for something more fractured or late session like last year?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the key to wrap up on is you know, where we almost started, which is what does core principles of good cause mean, and where do legislators sort of actually both A, find broad support for some version of good cause, and B, the ones who are really championing it willing to you know, accept some sort of compromise on it seems to be some of the key questions. And obviously, as we also talked about, what could be the details of a 421A replacement are hugely important when it comes to what the incentives are, what the labor standards are, what the affordability requirements are, geography involved in all of this, New York City, beyond New York City, et cetera. So a lot for people to obviously now be aware of and to follow along as these negotiations unfold, which they'll probably mostly unfold behind closed doors. But I can tell everyone listening this much, you can stay tuned to both this podcast and keep reading City Limits for a lot on what's happening around housing policy. Emma Whitford is deputy editor of City Limits. She covers housing and homelessness there, as well as doing some of that editing. Emma, thank you for taking this time, and I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Ben.